Yes, coming and goings we miss.
Yeah.
Well, a disciple of the Buddha asked him, how many bases of training were there for the seek, you know, to when you seek enlightenment? How many? And the Buddha replied, there are six: generosity, morality, tolerance or patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. These are the six paramitas. Paramita means gone to the other shore. We have a translation in English. It's called perfection, so we say the six perfections, which, you know, is really not so not the best, I would think.
That's a loaded
translation, because for us in English speaking, perfection has all kinds of connotations, and primarily that once you get there, you know, you've arrived, you've perfected it. But actually, in Buddhist practice, that's just not the case. There's continuous cultivation, just like there's continuous awakening. So it's not really the best word. So if I move around in the use of perfection, paramitas, you know, you have a more complete view of things to consider when you hear the word perfection. However, the paramitas are really more than just techniques or methods. You know, they are the fundamental way that one goes about training on this path. And how we do that, of course, is for us, all of us, a challenge, because we don't often think of the paramitas as a starting point, and yet they certainly are. So, seeking enlightenment, which is, I know we don't talk a lot about that in Zen, but you know, that's why we're here. We're here to wake up, so we can talk about it, I guess. So there, the paramitas are the ideal. So what is it that we're perfecting? It's our character. It's that aspect of our identity where we actually make choices. And the paramitas are there to support us in that. When you couple the paramitas with wisdom and compassion, you know, you have the enlightened character. So there is a process. And today I'm going to talk more about generosity as the first paramita, because generosity is considered the foundation first of as you train in these practices and bases. So we have to think about generosity in larger terms, not just the material aspect. It's actually more of a spirit of generosity, at least from the perspective of the Bodhisattva view. In the Prajna Paramita Sutras, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, generosity is highlighted for a couple of reasons. One is as a virtue, which would make sense. And then the second is that bodhisattvas are encouraged to train continuously in this practice of generosity. So there are two types of giving, certainly material goods, but then there is the giving of the Dharma, the teachings, and that's now you've moved into another realm of which is specifically in our practice. So when we are being generous of spirit, it really starts with renunciation of the self. And so that's an underlying element in the spirit of generosity. So keep that foremost in your mind. What does that really mean, renunciation of the self? So when we cultivate generosity, it's really not just for the poor, for the needy. It's really towards everyone. And the most important part is that it's based on non-discrimination and impartiality. In other words, there's some equanimity going on here. Everyone is seen as someone who can receive the generosity of a bodhisattva. In fact, if a bodhisattva or a practitioner, one and the same, have some sense of the self-satisfaction about a deed, you know, a good deed, that actually that gives you some hint right there that in a sense there's still some level of immaturity in terms of the willingness to relinquish the self. And so that attachment to self is very strong. So always be mindful when you're actually giving, because we're complex creatures and there's layering that's always present. So we know that there are stingy gifts, and then we know that there are magnanimous gifts. So there's the full range. We know in this practice we often speak of giver, receiver, and gift, all being one. And that's an important teaching, because what it's addressing is this very issue of no self, or that there is no separateness between self and other, or self and the giver as the giver and the other as the receiver, or even the gift. And when one is at that point or at that stage, then you could say that that's considered the super mundane perfection of generosity. So how does this happen? How do you actually experience this perfection? And it comes through realizing emptiness. So that's one of those Buddhist terms that sometimes trip people up, because sometimes it's translated as voidness, and people think that there's nothing. That means nothing. Nothingness. And that's not the case. Now we got nots and not nothing. But the when we talk about emptiness, it means that individuals, things, people, objects are do not exist independently. That they arise independent on something else. And so, in this way, you start to experience and see the interconnectedness of all being, and that you're not separate. You're not separate from your neighbor, right here. How are you connected? You're connected in emptiness. So emptiness arises because everything is always changing. Everything. Moment by moment. Everything in this room and around the world and in the universe is changing moment by moment. And that is really most difficult for us to grasp. But that's how reality is. And so when you experience this interconnectedness, you can spontaneously be generous towards each other or towards an animal or bird because they're not separate from you. So these other related teachings of impermanence and everything changing, there's no fixed self, dependent arising, and no self are all intimately related. And they're the stuff, the teachings of emptiness. So when one realizes emptiness, your view of the world changes. And as I said earlier, you spontaneously respond to what comes up. And in that sense, you can have the many different kinds or creative responses in terms of generosity. It isn't just the stuff of our lives that we share. It's really about responding to the person in terms of what they need, what presents itself, and then responding to that. There's a lessening of this attachment to self, and it shows up in that you're not so concerned about protecting the self, protecting the ego. And you're not as concerned about your own position in the world, you know, the could say self-aggrandizement, or you know how you would view yourself in relationship to others. That it actually takes second stage. I mean, second stage. Maybe that is right. I don't know.
Second fiddle.
Hey, that's good.
Second row,
that's it. Good. So, I have a story to tell, a Zen story. It comes out of this Zen flesh and Zen bones. And it's a story of the Zen master is Seisetsu. And he is the master of Engaku in Kamakura, Japan. And he's been teaching at that temple, and they're, you know, running out of space. They're very crowded in the school, and a wealthy merchant, and his name is Umezu, and he's very wealthy, and he sees that the Zen master needs more space in another school, so he decides that he's going to offer him some money, and he pulls together 500 pieces of gold. They call it real, 500 pieces. Now, normally, a person in Japan at that time could live on 3 ryo a year. So you can imagine, 500 was a lot of money. So he asked, Seisetsu, and he says, will you be willing to accept this gift, then, you know, Sesetsu says, yes, I'll take it. So he presents, you know, that merchant presents the sack of gold. And, you know, that's, you know, he gets handed to him, and, you know, he just takes it. And, you know, the merchant is, like, kind of miffed. Nothing was said. And so he says, Master, this sack of gold has over 500 pieces of real in it. And the Zen master says, yes, yes, I recall, you told me. And the merchant is like, so Sesetsu says, well, do you think I should thank you? And, you know, the merchant says, well, yes, of course. And Sesetsu says, it should be you thanking me. So why would he say that? Well, because both the donor and the recipient really share in this experience of generosity. And in non-separateness, there is no need to say thank you. But here in courtesy, of course, we do those kinds of things. But there's also the issue of spiritual merit. And, you know, this is something that's, well, we all know the story of Bodhidharma, you know, where the emperor says, you know, here I'm putting all these temples together, how much merit do I get? And Bodhidharma says, no merit, which really kind of annoyed the emperor to no end. But in our practice, we have what's called echo, that's chanted as part of when we, after our offering.
Transferring merit.
Transferring merit, right. Yeah. It's transferring merit to others, right? This is very interesting that we do this. We don't really talk much about it, but that's what it is. It's a transference of merit to other beings who may benefit from it. So it actually helps reduce for the practitioner this spiritual selfishness, you know, that we somehow need our own merit, you know. But actually, it's something that I feel one experiences in their journey on the path, where you actually, at some point, freely give your merit to others, and it just arises naturally. And I think it's in response to the generosity of the, you know, universe about what you're receiving, and in turn are able to give it to others. So in the early Mahayana texts, generosity or giving was really seen as a meditation. So as part of the offering, when one would start, you know, sit down to zazen, there would be a mental exercise of offering the merit to others. And you might offer, for example, healing thoughts to somebody you know who is in need, or you might offer the light of the universe to others, or the greenness of the grass, or the color of fall to somebody. There is, in that sense, there's, this is, you know, showing appreciation for what is, whatever is going on, and then offering that up. So there's both the acknowledgement of this, and the willingness to share and give it to others. So one part of that I thought was, for me, somewhat surprising. The text or the material that I'm using is The Six Perfections, and it's a book written by Dale Wright. And in there, he says that as the Bodhisattva continues in their cultivation of generosity, that the generosity arises out of deep compassion. And that Wright says that compassion really isn't innate in us, and that it's actually a function of the practice of giving. So giving is actually very important at the start of your practice and all the way through it, in the middle and at the end, however, you know, we're all practicing. And the reason is that because it begins the process of the letting go of the self. So that just the act of giving, you start to see that your self is not so important, that something else is more important, that you want to give. And so this practice of letting go of the self is probably the most challenging of all the things that I think as practitioners we have to do, because the teaching of no self is a continuous practice, and since we are all very attached to ourselves, that the myriad ways it shows up, we have a lifetime of work just in that. So no self is really fundamental teaching, and it's actually the root of ignorance, our attachment to self, because we see ourselves as separate from everything else. And that's why we have to practice generosity, is to chip away at that belief that we're separate. So I was thinking about these paramitas as in my own mind I was looping around in some mind stream that has been going on for a while. And, you know, I thought, well, take refuge in the paramitas. Take refuge in generosity. What does that really mean? How can I extricate myself from that mental looping? I can, with the idea, with generosity, by starting to see that and letting go, that I am not separate from the belief or the person or whatever I'm looping in my mind about. And that stickiness of those ideas starts to lessen, because you actually can see a way out. And first observing it is the first step. So now, there's a lot all of you know about generosity, and so maybe you could share it. Because now, you know, you hear what these teachings are, but we also know we have to live in our everyday life. Mm-hmm. And so how do we live with generosity? So what are the reasons we give? Anybody have thoughts on why we give? Why do you give? I mean, you must get begging letters in the mail, right? We all get, you know, for this, that, and the other cause. You know, why do you give? Any thoughts? No?
It feels natural. Mm-hmm. I don't give so much financially because there's not that much financially, but just giving to another human being always just feels like, I don't know, when that kind of thing arises, it's just what's to be done, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any others? Yes.
I give sometimes because it feels lousy if I don't.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is probably a corollary to what you just said.
Well, it's the, you know, it's another aspect of giving too, because you know, it's good to recognize our motivations or the result, because then we know where we are, right? We know what makes us feel good, what makes us feel bad. If we, you know, it's like as we have all experienced, you know, giving to a homeless person, right? I mean, we are, whether you're in San Francisco or in Sunnyvale, there are homeless people. And, you know, they're either on the corner or by a store or, you know, wherever. And, you know, how does that feel when, you know, do you give? And if not, why not? Yes?
I'm honestly having trouble identifying within my own experience, like, experiences where I've given without a very subconscious ego need attached to it. I'm having a lot of trouble thinking of
Mm-hmm.
Hear that. Mm-hmm. Be it a thank you or a gratification or my own high.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I could use speak towards that.
Well, I think it's just it's a good awareness to actually see that, and you can see maybe over time it'll change. So, but to start to see how we have expectations, even if they're just about the way our own feelings or our own response, I think it's very interesting how giving brings up some of that.
Sometimes when we give a gift, we don't completely give it because we have some expectations about how it's going to be used. Mm-hmm. Like your story, mm-hmm. Yeah. So, in a sense, we're pulling it back with our strength. We have these strings of our mm-hmm. expectations. So, you say, I'll give you this gift if you use it the way I think you should use it.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they say one of the best gifts to give is a gift that completely disappears. Like when we give incense,
mm-hmm.
the incense disappears. It's sweet smoke and it goes mm-hmm. into the atmosphere mm-hmm. and everything. But it doesn't stick around. You know? It does mm-hmm. not stick around. But if we give a gift to a friend and they're a close friend, then we think, hey, are you using that well? Or have you? I just gave you this car and you smashed it up or something.
I had a conversation with someone about 3 or 4 months ago, and this person is a very generous person. And I was telling her, I said, "Do you realize how special you are? Named a number of things that she does." And she said, "What are you talking about?" And she really was unable to see the specialness of her just generosity. So, she wasn't making it up.
Mm-hmm.
She literally did not know what I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be clear to me and probably anybody else that would observe it that this person was always giving, and not always, but had a tendency to be very generous. And I thought at the time that I had a greater grasp on what was happening, because I thought she was so special. And but now, after listening to you, I'm wondering really whether she embodied the giver and the gift and the recipient all at once. I mean, to me, she, now that after hearing you, I'm seeing that she was way beyond my idea of what it was. And I haven't really seen that very often, where someone literally is a giver but has no clue. And when you compliment them for being, I think her attitude was, what else would I do? There wasn't another aspect to it. So that was. Thank you for.
There's a story that someone asked, what is a Buddha? What is the function of the Buddha? You probably know this. So the function of the Buddha, or the activity of the Buddha, after his enlightenment experience. And this is one of these koans, kind of question and answer. And the answer was simply an appropriate response. So it brings to mind that she was just responding, in her view, just appropriately, just doing what was appropriate. Yeah.
That's a perfect way of explaining it. It was a really difficult conversation. I spoke with her for an hour trying to convince her how special she was, and she wasn't buying it. And I also wanted to say what a great opportunity for the Tenzo to give a gift that disappears.
There you go.
As a professional cook, or ex-professional cook, you know.
No, you know, it's just the right amount. See, that's his gift.
Isn't that what Ryoki means? Mm-hmm. Just enough, or just
enough.
Right, just the right amount.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, Sharon.
So, I think there's more than just that it disappears, because unless, of course, you intend it to disappear, because I was thinking of something that I gave once, and afterward I was really sorry that I gave it and wished I had it back. And it was gone, you know, out of my life. It's not like I could go back to the person, and because I don't even know who had it. But and so in a way, it wasn't really given, in the sense that we're talking about, because I didn't feel good about it, and so that's the difference.
Right, so there are some, you know, we could look at, you know, maybe imperfections in giving, or we could look at misguided, you know, there are people who maybe give way beyond their capacity, you know, like they give to the point of, you know, self-destruction, you know, in a sense. You know, people who have given much more than they can afford, and they end up going in debt. They give, you know, for various reasons, what appears to be altruistic, but in fact they have low self-esteem, or they, you know, they're misguided in the way they're thinking about it. And you know, so it's a very strange, in a sense, twisted view of generosity. And I think what's missing is that they're not experiencing the emptiness aspect of their generosity. That they overcompensate, keep giving, but they don't really see how not only does the there's no separateness, but there's really no gift, no receiver, no donor. They're all empty. And if you ignore that, then you can maybe fall into these extremes of giving and have some, in a sense, misguided giving. Yes?
I liked your description of Paramita as crossing to the other shore. So, in a way, a Paramita is a raft, a platform from which to operate. And it takes a giver, a gift, and a receiver And part of giving is, you know, you're talking about giving, but there's also receiving a gift is a huge gift the receiver gives to the giver and to the gift. And you can belittle the circumstance easily.
Thank you.
Isn't that when someone compliments you and you disclaim it? Isn't that called a discount?
Mm-hmm.
You discount the compliment.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Not like, you know, a bargain store discount. The other kind of discount.
Yes, Peter.
A comment on earlier discussion about giving and how often we have strings attached and you know, how we practice not giving in that sense. And see our practice of Zazen is a constant repetition of that because we sit with no strings attached, with no gaining idea, just sitting. Mm-hmm. And it's a constant practice of giving without any expectation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. More developed story in the middle-length discourses of the Buddha on this what you bring up about the raft, and the story goes like, you know, the Buddha's telling the story about, you know, the people who will take the raft and use the raft to cross to the other shore. But then he asks his disciples, "Well, disciples, what if?" When you arrive at the other shore, you take the raft and put it on your shoulders and you carry on. You know, was that useful? And they say, no, Buddha, wasn't useful to do that. That's not. So he says, well, then there's another person who takes the raft, and when he gets across to the other shore, he leaves it at the shore and carries on. And so this Buddha asks the disciples, well, what was that? You know, the right response. And they said, yes. Yeah. So he says the difference between the two is that even when things are good and they're working for you, you have to let go of them too. So, you know, it's like constant, as you were saying, Peter, this whole thing of non-attachment, of letting go, is continuous. Even off the cushion, we practice it, learning how to do it in Zazen, and we must continue that practice in everyday life of letting go. No matter if something is handed to us as a very valuable gift, and we've received it, but we have to let that go too. So that might be related to both in terms of receiving and in giving. When we would think of skillful means. That's important, yes.
Giving is fun, you know. And it's temporary experience, like you said, it's empty of permanence. But it's a renewable experience because there's always another time to do it. And it also is a means of engagement to meet somebody else, and to I find it useful just because I like to engage with people, and you can engage. That's an easy way to engage, is to, hey, can I help you?
Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, no thanks. But another time, maybe so. And then it's like, yeah. Then you get to. Rumble about, you know, and have some time to explore this.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, in a way, it's a platform again of experience, an opportunity of experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's some kind of a cycle involved in giving, like we were having tea. And then Chris gave me this really nice pot of tea. pain, so I poured some. And like if I kept it, then the next period zazen, you know, drunk the whole thing would have been really uncomfortable. But then I gave it to Greg, and that felt really good. And it seemed the whole beauty of the pot of tea moving around the world, around said world, but I meant this room. But it is that just taking part in that cycle is beautiful. And then rather than me having all the tea, I shared my experience with these people, and I feel less alone.
Mm-hmm.
How do we cultivate more of that? Because that's nice.
It's interesting how habitually we just think that this bag of skin is our body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we know we're not. It's not. It's more than that. Mm-hmm. So when you had that experience, it felt like it's almost like your body expanded to include the whole circle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you gave yourself to yourself. You gave tea to yourself. You received it from yourself, and you passed it on to yourself, and so on. Kind of. Yeah.
Well, that's like saying that a whole world is in some, you know, in each of our experiences, and we don't see the whole world. So even your use of the word world, I thought was, because it's more than just a circle. It is a whole world. It's the experience, when you're having that experience, It is the world. It is it. It isn't just the circle. It's all of reality that's happening. And so that's the non-separation of that experience. It's a kind of a... So I think when you say, how does one cultivate something like this, I think some of it is looking, you know, is really looking at deeply your motivations. And, you know, seeing if you're really, what you're really attached to. What it seems to be your sticking point. And then see if you can observe that throughout, you know, your days. And you can do that by just setting an intention at the beginning of the day. If you know you tend to be I would say, you know, have high expectations. If you're that kind of person, let's say, you have expectations. You may want to set that vow in the morning when you first wake up that you would like to see how you, those expectations that day. See it on anything.
How they arise.
How do they arise, right. Yeah. Well, a lot of it, you can't see the arising, you just see it. You all of a sudden hear yourself say something like, well, I was thinking I wanted that, you know, and in a way, by your statement, when you hear yourself speak, then you say, oh my God, I'm expecting something. So set the intention first thing, and you can start getting into what your mind is up to. You'll start seeing it. It's very interesting that you will actually wake up to what you're doing during the day if you set that intention. And then when you get forgetful or you're not really that interested anymore in that particular expression, go find something else in your mind that you seem to notice there's some habituation. And again, set another intention in the morning. It will show up. I guarantee it. It's just amazing how our mind works. Give it a shot. So, yes?
You said something I thought was kind of a troublesome, dangerous kind of expression to me. You were talking about generosity being the beginning of the renunciation of the self, or something along those lines. And what is been key in my practice for at least a year is that this whole issue of acceptance and of self and renunciation of self. I think for myself, I'll just speak for myself, I think there's an element of not accepting myself that has brought me into practice.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of renunciating yourself, the self, is kind of, in a sense, goes against, you know, modern psychology, right? And because if you're not accepting who you are, everything like that, well, you're not going to get anywhere. And so what I thought when you said that first was like, how does that work? For me to be generous, it seems like I'm renunciating myself, I'm not being generous to myself or whatever. And I think the phrase came into my mind is to accept the self is to renounce the self. If you can, mm-hmm. if I can start from a place of acceptance,
mm-hmm.
that's the only place I can be to even begin to explore what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think it would really be problematic. You mm-hmm. know, like, where would I get if I was just at a point where I was just not accepting this self who, in a sense, does exist for me?
So I think it is a good place that you're starting at. I think the there are some finer points that I should probably clarify, and that is that we're not destroying the ego. So you need your ego to carry on your everyday life. What we're talking about is your attachment to your ideas, to your beliefs of who you think you are, and to your stuff. Those are the things we're talking about when we talk about no self. So if you can see the subtleties of, you know, this teaching, it's, you know, because if you first must accept yourself, and that is a constellation of, you know, of Chris and who you think you are, then, you know, that's where you're starting. And then, you know, as you move in your practice, then you can see, well, maybe Chris isn't only this. Maybe there's more to Chris than I've given credit to myself. And maybe that was Chris yesterday, but it's not Chris today. So the idea of a fixed self is also another element in that. So, yeah, it's a. I think everybody has to start with where they are. But if you have an understanding of the teaching, then you will, you know, move forward in and progress in that. Because it's most difficult, I think, in our practice, because it's not culturally something we ever talk about. I mean, in America, I never heard the teaching of no self growing up. Nobody told me that. You know, you are who you are. You're so-and-so. You know, you're this person's daughter, and you're this way, and you're, you know, you're always that way. People tell you that all the time. You're that way. You are that, you know. I changed the color of my hair once, and my uncle said, I never know who you are now. You used to only be blonde. Well, I said, this is it. This is my natural color. He couldn't accept. And now, you know, I was like, well, that was me then, you know. Who's to say? I wasn't this then. I don't know. So, but thank you. Thank you. Because it is it's like the nuts and bolts of our practice. It's a tough issue. So what about gifts of criticism?
Philanthropist.
Philanthropist, what? Tell us more. So what happens when criticism works? When does criticism work?
Sometimes.
Sometimes. Well, what?
When you
what?
Can hear it.
When you can hear it. There you go. Receiving. Yes.
It's given with a generous spirit. Mm-hmm. Certainly not. Criticism hardly ever works when the person telling you is not looking out for you, but just
being helpful or something. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So not, and there's not discouragement at the end of it. You know, you have this.
But when I said sometimes, I meant sometimes, like timing.
Yes.
Oh, like timing. There are sometimes. Mm-hmm. Because you could have the same spirit, and they could have the same spirit, but it could be the wrong time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's going back to skillful means. You know, what's about, you know, when to give a gift, what when we receive, you know, and what is the gift, and so there is that. Yes.
I guess when you put it on yourself and not on the person that you're giving the criticism to.
Mm.
So let's say I'm not criticizing you. Making comments about us, in a way. You know, mm-hmm. Like, it's my experience that when you do this, and I feel this, mm-hmm. So it's, I'm not pointing at you, mm-hmm. Saying you're bad.
Right, so it's you're taking more the ownership of your feelings and in mm-hmm. your expression instead of saying you, you know, giving the you finger. You are not that way, or are this way. Mm-hmm.
And I also think that not being attached to the result helps.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's good. So, what about the gift? What can be given? What kinds of things?
Yeah, what'd you give me?
Yeah. A good laugh. Hey, how about that?
I gotta run off.
Okay. We wouldn't want to keep you saying thank you.
Should we have a fire tonight?
Yeah, that'd be
lovely. Yes.
Thank you. That's a gift.
There you go. So how about apologies? Are those gifts?
I think they can be sometimes.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That opens up the possibilities. Spaciousness.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes your company is actually a gift.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
My brother and I do an interesting thing, because I find if I'm trying to clean up my house, it's just another person's presence, even if they're not helping me, makes a big difference. And my brother has the same experience, but, you know, he lives in Baltimore. And so we make appointments with each other to call each other on the phone and put each other on speakerphone, so if we have something to say, we can hear it. And so we're in each other's presence. Mm-hmm. And we each work on our own stuff. But we're given, and it's working. I mean, it's amazing. But it's like the gift of that amount of time that mm-hmm. we actually give each other. Mm-hmm. It's very unusual.
Yes, but it works. Huh? That's the creative spirit of generosity at work, where we don't really, we can't put definitions on what is generosity. Mm-hmm. We should allow it to arise from the situation, and that will tell us. Now, how?
And it's not a thing. It's mm-hmm. giving me more, much more than I'm getting, you know, mm-hmm. getting from it. Well, it's much more, you know, I don't feel like I'm giving anything. I'm getting, and he's getting.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, we're both giving without focusing on that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all
mm-hmm.
a big pot.
Mm-hmm. No separation between mm-hmm. what's really going,
getting,
you know, that between the giving and receiving and the actual
mm-hmm.
gift of shared time.
It almost feels like, I'm getting a sense like the immaterial is more rewarding than the material in
mm-hmm.
terms of like what a gift is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like visiting someone in the hospital is a great gift. You don't have to bring anything.
Mm-hmm. So there are many ways of giving, and I think as practitioners, this is, since it's so important to our practice to start opening ourselves up to the present, and because of our practice of Zazen, we can be present. And what happens is if you can hold that experience, hold that presence, and allow prajna to come up. Prajna is wisdom. And in each of the paramitas, wisdom is infused into the perfection, into the paramita, and actually what is the more of the cultivation aspect. And again, and to respond to your question, how do we do this? It's actually being present with what's arising so that you can respond and allow that prajna to come up to direct you, to give you the clues as to what to do. It's what prajna does. Prajna helps you with your decisions. It gives you the clue. It says, hey, how about this? How about that? It just arises spontaneously. So if you're anxious or uncomfortable or, you know, domineering in situations, what'll happen is that nothing. No prajna, because you haven't allowed it to come forth. So actually being patient, which we'll talk about a little bit more down another day, but being present, just hold that space. See if you can hold that space to see what's arising. Just be present. And allow prajna to work for you, to work with you. And you'll find the generosity just keeps coming. It's not difficult. Because you are infused with the wisdom of your true self.
I have just a little... I don't know, I shouldn't give it a size. When people talk about random acts of kindness, I mean, would that sort of fall in that category,
mm-hmm.
if you want to call it a category?
Mm-hmm. Right, because
that
they're spontaneous.
Nice practice. Just think of, wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do random acts of kindness.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't look for them. I mean, if I look around in this room, I can't say, oh, I'm going to do one right now, because, you know, it's pretty good. I'm sure each one of you can think of something I could do for you, but...
but we got to have it. We can't have
but,
the thought.
Yeah,
there.
It's
yeah.
not. But it does come up. If you just have that in
mm-hmm.
somewhere in the back of your mind, it does come up.
That's going back to intention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.